listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema with Big Willie and the Samurai, bringing class to trash since 1977.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. We have a very special episode for you this week. This week, we have wrangled an interview with one of our favorite actors. I'm getting Skype messages. Mr. Thomas Jane. So, Tom, how you doing?
Hey, fellas, how are you? I'm at the Los Angeles flea market here with my daughter, and we're running around looking for different unspecified stuff that the 9-year-old is, you know, desperate to find. We've already been here, but we haven't been around the corner and back up that way. They have other stuff like you're looking for. So it's great to be here, fellas. Thanks for having us on. And I guess it was Dave Alcock that made this all possible. And Davey's here, right?
Yeah, he's here. He just, for some strange reason, he just dropped out of the call, and I'm trying to get him back on the line, so perfect timing.
Okay.
There he is. Sure he's back.
I'm back. Hi. Sorry. Yes.
All right. I was just saying, David, that...
You're just telling them what a wonderful person I am.
Yeah, I wonder how great it was that you were sober enough to be able to talk to us.
For once.
Yeah, we have some experience with Dave, so we understand that sober comment. Yes.
When we get off the phone, then Dave and I can tell you a few stories about us bumming around London together. That was kind of unforgettable.
And you're saying that I'm sober for once.
Well, it's been a while since we've gotten to raise a glass, me and Davey.
Yeah, and that's probably quite a good thing, actually.
And that's a good thing for all of our families.
It is for our families and the residents of
Central. The last time I saw Dave, you didn't have a family, but now you do, right?
I do. I think last time I saw you, my daughter was one. Yeah, she's 2.5 now, yeah.
That's fantastic, man.
And we have another one on the way in January.
Nice.
All right. Congratulations. Yeah. That's super great. You know, when I ran into Dave, he was a single guy. He was roostering around.
Oh, yeah.
And we used to have a great time.
We did.
Now we both have families and responsibilities. But we're also doing... we love, right, Dave?
Yeah, totally. Times have changed, but I'm very, very happily married, trying to be the best father I can. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Nice.
Yeah. Tell us about what you're doing. Are you still doing storyboards or production art design?
Yeah, man, it's storyboards all the way. At the moment, I'm doing a movie called All You Need Is Kill, Doug Liman movie, Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt. Just finished Fast and the Furious Part 6. It's all good stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
They're still making those Fast and the Furious movies.
Yeah, man, yeah, they're churning them out.
So Dave and I met on a movie that we shot over at Shepparton called Mutant Chronicles.
Yeah.
And we had a great time. And Dave was doing some conceptual stuff, and he was also doing some storyboards for them, but mostly conceptual stuff, I thought. Is that right?
No, we started off doing concepts and designs, and that kind of segued into the storyboard once they started shooting. I think that's when I met you.
Right. And I kind of, Dave hit it off, and he was doing some great work, and I knew that I was going to be directing my first film called Dark Country, which was the first movie to be shot in digital 3D.
Right.
We shot it way before the digital 3D kind of craze took over in Hollywood. So we invented this whole process of making a digital 3D film because it's never been done before. And a lot of the workflow that we established is still being used today. But the reason why I say that is because I wanted to storyboard the entire film because I was worried about the technical aspect of making a 3D movie that had never been done before.
Right.
So it being my first film, I thought, you know, I really want to dial this in, you know, plus the fact I'm acting in it. So I hooked up with Dave, and we actually flew him out to California, and we spent a week or two holed up in my house with a little model car and a stack of paper. And we roughly sketched in the storyboards of the entire film. It was a really fun.
Oh, wow.
Invigorating experience. It was great. I mean, I guess a lot of people might find that incredibly tedious to spend a week or two holed up in a house, drawing, making pictures. for 8 or 10 hours a day. It was probably longer than that, but man, I just remember that so fondly. It's having such a great time.
It was great, and I have to say, it still is to this day my favorite and my best working experience so far.
Nice.
That's great.
It was like, you know, it was like being a kid again, and, you know, Tom was rolling around on the floor acting the thing out, and we were doing fight scenes and toy car and toy soldiers, and his brother was kind of like running back and forth scanning them in, and then we'd go out to lunch and come back and draw some more. It's fucking great. You know, it's what it's all about.
Yeah.
True. Yeah. Well, we did some really nice work.
Yeah, it was great.
And now and some of the work can be seen in the graphic novel. We reprinted a lot of Dave's storyboards.
Yeah, it's really nice presentation.
Yeah, the Dark Country graphic novel that you can order from Diamond, I think. I know that the book hit bookshops this month in America. If you know how to get comics and graphic novels sent over from America, then you can grab the Dark Country graphic novel. Thomas Ott did the illustrations, and we have the original short story by Tab Murphy, and we also have 40 or so pages of production art that Dave Alcock did with storyboards, and Bernie Wrightson also did some character designs. Really,
oh wow,
great stuff.
Yeah.
How'd you wrangle Wrightson into that, Tom?
Oh hell yeah, yeah. I know, for Bernie was a friend. And
cool.
And he designed our creature, our bad guy.
That's
in
fantastic.
Dark Country. Bloody Face.
Yeah. Yeah, Bloody Face.
And we had a lot of fun with all the artists that were involved. And Tim Bradstreet put the book together. That's a cool blue hat right there. I think you should get that blue hat. Cowboy hat.
I said to Rick, actually.
So,
all right, Tom, do you mind if we get into a few of the questions then?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, you're going to ask me questions? Great.
Yeah.
I thought I was just going to ramble on for a couple hours, but go ahead.
No, we wanted to see, you know, we just want to ask some basic questions, you know, if you could tell our listeners kind of how you got into film. We think it, Will asked, you know, if it was through Bollywood or something like that, but could you kind of give us an idea how you kind of got started?
Yeah, I mean, I'll keep it short. You know, it's a nice long story, but the long and the short of it is that I dropped out of high school when I was about 16 years old, and I started going to an acting school in Maryland called the Maryland Academy of Dramatic Arts. It was a little tiny school above a liquor store. It was run by a guy named Ralph Tabakin, who's in all of Barry Levinson's films. You'll see old Ralph. He looks kind of like Popeye, and he's a big, bushy, gray eyebrows, and older gentleman. He's a vaudeville actor. And you want to play? I'm following you, girl. I know, I'm following you, lady. All right. Follow each other. Where do you want to go? Huh? Don't dub me. Where do you want to go? You don't know? No, I don't know where. Let's go this way. So, flea market with a 9-year-old. So, Ralph, you know, taught me a lot about acting, but while I was sweeping floors at the hardware store, Ralph called me up and he said that these Indians had come to town from Bollywood and they were going to make a Bollywood movie and they're looking for a white kid, a blonde haired, blue eyed white kid to star in their Bollywood film. I had no idea. You know, I was like, India? You mean like Indians? Like cowboys and Indians? And he goes, no. He goes, you go down there and you get the part. And I get 10%, you see, because I'm acting as your agent. I said, Ralph, I can't go, you know. Why not? Why? I don't have blue eyes, man. He goes, you got blue eyes now. You get down there and you get the part. And I did. I went down there and auditioned for these lovely crew of Indians and who were making a Telugu film in southern India and got the part. And we ran all over the country making this movie for about 3 months. And then we all packed up and went to India.
Talk about being thrust into
it. So I lived over there for about 6 months, and I made another little movie when I was over there. And I was 16. I turned 17 in Madras, which is now called Chennai, I think.
Wow.
And the food department. Let's get out of here. And that was it. You know, I came back. They didn't have money to pay me, so they gave me the RV that they bought to drive around. The little starlet and some of the crew that we used. You know, we had a couple of vans that the crew drove in, and we had a big RV. And they gave me the RV, and I remember, you know, at 16 years old, 17, getting back with this fucking RV. We had a lot of fun with that with my friends. Became the party mobile for a little while. And then it broke down on the New Jersey Turnpike, and I traded it to a mechanic who had a 1969 Camaro convertible.
Beauty.
And I left it. I left this giant 37-foot RV on the side of the New Jersey Turnpike and went and picked up this convertible 69 Camaro and drove it across the country. I went to Hollywood.
Turned out well.
And I lived, I didn't know anybody when I got to town. I turned 18 in San Francisco, and then I turned 19 in Los Angeles. And I bummed around in the seedier part of Hollywood for quite a while before I started going to acting school over there, and then that led to theater. You know, and we built our own theater in East Hollywood, rented a storefront and gutted it and built the seats and the lights and the stage and backstage, and we built this whole theater and we ran the lights and we did plays, and of course it, you know, barely broke even doing theater in Hollywood. You know, I have to tell you what that's like. And
then
that was kind of my life. I mean, I lived in the theater from time to time. You know, it was a matter of just not wanting to get a real job. And I think that all the people that I was kind of coming up with that decided that they liked, you know, eating dinner every night and having a place to shit and shower and shave. Those are generally the people that, you know, that decided to do something else with their lives. But it was never a question for me. You know, I just knew that I was going to do this or I was sort of literally going to die trying. So.
Well, you seem to pack a lot into 3 years. I mean, I can't imagine being 16, traveling, being thrust into another country's film system, back in an unfamiliar part of the country on a different coast, certainly must have been daunting. But, I mean, you obviously, it worked out in hindsight.
Yeah, in hindsight. But in the middle of it, you know, I mean, there were a lot of nights where I lay there going, what the F am I doing?
Sure.
You know?
How can you not until something tangible tells you otherwise, yeah?
Yeah. Well, you know.
Now, you...
A buddy of mine's father was a commercial director, and he cast me in my first commercial, and that's how I got my SAG card. I played a chicken at a lawn on my way to a costume party in a Coca-Cola commercial. You know, and this director was nice enough to let me take my helmet off. You know, my chicken hat, my chicken costume is nice enough to say, hey, take your helmet off and you see your face and get your SAG card. I was like, well, that's fucking cool. You know?
I wonder if that so
that's how I got
around.
My SAG card and managed to stay in the union ever since. It's good.
Oh, definitely. Now, you know, you look back in preparing for the interview, I know Rick and I were big fans of your stuff. And one of the reasons we're big fans of the stuff you do is the lean you tend to take with a lot of your choices. There seems to be, you know, some people treat it seems as a business. They take roles for certain reasons, but it seems that there's a lot of love put into the stuff you choose. And the motivation behind you choosing it seems to be stuff you're passionate about. It's sort of pulpy or more genre-based stuff. I would imagine this is, you know, because you have a passion for that sort of, that world, the genre world, more pulpy stuff. I would assume that's correct. Right, Tom?
Absolutely correct. You know, but I think it's done some good things, you know, and it's sort of served me and I've gotten to be involved with some really good pulpy stuff. But, you know, there's also, it's that world. I mean, I guess every genre has its, you know, has its good and its bad qualities and good and bad movies. But, and, you know, and sort of a double-edged sword. I mean, you know, it's, you don't find a lot of great acting in the pulpier, material. And that's what always, you know, bothered me. And it's always something that I've strive to change, but believe me, man, a lot of the times it's just like, you know, fighting windmills. It's you know, I mean, it's hard.
Mm-hmm,
and there's a lot of resistance. I mean, there seems to be some weird kind of division where if it's a pulpy kind of a material, then the writing's not going to be so good. And that just, I mean, I fight that all the time. I'm trying to find great material that's also, I mean, I was inspired as a kid by movies like Alien. Mm-hmm. But it turns out, you know, they still haven't made a movie as good as Alien. It came out in 1979.
Yeah.
So, you know, but when I was a kid and I saw that, I was literally 8 years old, and that's what kind of, you know, that's what sort of warped me for the rest of my life is this, when my parents didn't really have money for babysitters, so they used to take us to see this stuff, you know, and my poor sister was only four or five years old, and we're sitting there, me and her, watching Alien, you know, and well, you know, I mean, it was the 70s, man. You know,
the parents
did this kind of stuff, and
yeah.
And but as an 8 year old, that left an indelible impression upon me.
Mm-hmm.
And it still affects me today, and it still colors the type of decisions that I, the kind of stuff that I look for, you know, and those are the kind of movies that turned me on. I like movies like 2001.
Right.
I love the Indiana Jones series. I love Jaws. I was inundated with that stuff as a young kid, so. I'm talking about I was like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, and we had Jaws and Star Wars and Indiana Jones and 2001. My dad had showed me on the VHS when he first brought that suitcase home and punched this big plastic thing in the bottom and watch a movie. That was like, that was insane. You know, the first movie that he bought was 2001.
Wow.
And I must have seen that 30 times, you know, and it just blew my mind.
Right.
And those are the kind of movies that I'm still looking to do today. And I'm very proud of The Mist that I got to do with Turbine.
Oh, tremendous work.
But you know, creating that kind of material, it ain't easy, you know, recognize that. But at the time, I was like, oh, this is the kind of movies that I want to make. And I thought that this is the kind of movies that would be made over and over again for as long as I live and go to Hollywood and do those kind of movies. You know, it turns out that those are still, you know, high water marks for the genres that they're in.
Yep.
So, but, you know, I started Ross Studios as an elevated genre company, and we try to emulate the high water marks of science fiction, horror, noir, you know, western, whatever the genre may be. And you know, and I like all that stuff. And mm-hmm. I love when I got in my 20s, I discovered the film noir, which was a direct outcropping for me from the Twilight Zone,
right,
and the Outer Limits, you know. But that's how we discovered film noir. Yeah, let's go home, and then we'll go there in a little while. We'll bust back out. Let's go feed the cat.
Yeah, Tom, I got to say, you really nailed the film noir elements in Dark Country. I got to give you that because I had not seen the film. I just recently watched it about three weeks ago. And it's just one of those films that kind of avoided me forever. But I finally got around to watching it. And, man, you really hit it on the head, that film noir element. And I thought it was really great.
We showed it to the Film Noir Foundation, last year in I guess, November. We showed it, get the heck in the car, to the up in San Francisco. Eddie Muller runs the Film Noir Foundation, and he brought me up there, and we showed the screen. We showed the Dark Country at Castro Theater, and about 600 Film Noir fanatics showed up, and it was the first time that, you know, Dark Country had actually had a paying audience where people bought a ticket and sat down and watched the movie. And I tell you, that was such a gratifying experience because the film noir, you know, community is not the biggest community in the world. But
right.
to the guys who appreciate the genre, they really, really loved the movie, and we stayed and talked to them for about 45 minutes after. And it was a gratifying experience. All the different references that I'd thrown in there, they were obvious to this group of people. And we've had some really successful screenings at Comic-Con, the Long Beach Comic-Con. We had a couple of nights there where it went well. When the movie finds its audience, it plays really well. In fact, we're doing a screening on October 28th here at the Downtown Independent Theater. Eddie Muller's coming down from San Francisco, and we're going to kind of recreate the Film Noir Foundation night up at the Castro downtown Los Angeles at the Independent. So if anybody's listening and happens to be in the area, come on down October 28th. And we'll have a great 3D screening of Dark Country and of Inferno, which is a 1950s 3D film noir in color. It's actually a really good movie. We're starting the car here, so so I know you'll be a little noisy for a minute. What's the beeping? I know, but we're going to hit something. All right. Well, thanks. I'm glad you got to watch the movie. That was film school for me. Dave, we recreated the storyboards very faithfully. So it must have been a kick for Dave to watch.
It was. Because I mean, the thing is with storyboarding, it's a guide. It's not the Bible. It's a guide. It's kind of visual, turning
framework.
words into pictures. It's like visual scripting. And very rarely sometimes you get it. But I was amazed how closely Tom stuck to the board. And of course, for me, it's incredibly gratifying when anything like that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes it works. It's for the good, and sometimes for the bad. But I think it worked really well for Tom. Yeah.
Yeah, it was super fun. You know, I'm working on a Western now. We're going to shoot it in April. We're going to shoot in Monument Valley.
Nice.
You know, I watch at least one, sometimes two Westerns every night.
Hello.
I've been watching so much John Ford lately. And my God, I feel gratified that I get to see him, but I'm also sad that I waited so long to watch all this amazing John Ford stuff. Anybody who's interested in film, you know, at all, should definitely check out all the classic John Ford movies, like How Green Was My Valley, or The Lost Patrol, or, you know, My Darling Clementine, and then, of course, all the great westerns that he made, but The Grapes of Wrath. I mean, these movies are pure poetry. I mean, there's some, I think How Green Was My Valley, I think, is the most powerful filmic movie I've ever seen. The images are so emotionally evocative, and they're so goddamn gorgeous. Yeah. It far exceeds anything that's being done today.
Yeah. Yeah, we're big fans of Ford, Will and I. We love him quite a bit. I'm a huge fan of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. A big fan of that one.
Yeah. Lord.
And even, sure. You're a big fan of Bud Bedeker, Tom? He's great.
Yeah. I haven't actually got into the Bedeker films, but I'm watching a lot of Anthony Mann.
Yeah. I tend to mix the two up sometimes.
And then, of course, Howard Hawks has done some great ones. You know, Red River is one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a great one. I'm glad you're going into the Western. I'm glad you're doing a Western, because I've always thought you have a classic Western look.
Yeah.
And it's going to be really great to see you in that genre.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I've heard that from I've heard that, you know, quite a bit.
Yep.
Yeah, the profile, kind of, right? I mean, it's there.
Yep.
Yeah, so I'm excited to, you know, so a lot of people have always said, you know, you really got to do a Western. So I found this great screenplay by a guy named Jose Brindis. He wrote this script called A Magnificent Death from a Shattered Hand. And I optioned the screenplay for him and worked on it with him for a while. Hang on.
Just a great title. Magnificent Death by a Shattered Hand. It's a giallo title.
Yeah, no, it's like a giallo western.
So... Sorry, guys.
No.
So yeah, it's worked on the script, and we got Nick Nolte, who's we're talking to.
Nice.
To Nick about starring in the film, and we're talking to some other really terrific actors, and we're almost got our budget together, and then me and Davey have to have a conversation about, you know, and I don't want to storyboard the whole film this time.
No.
I do want to, there's a fantastic stagecoach robbery that we've scripted. And I'd love to set you loose on that if you had a little bit of time, Davey.
I'd love to. And, I had such a great time on Dark Country that, yeah, of course, definitely.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, we'll figure out, you know, the dates and everything. And I'm, of course, trying to get these guys to start cash flowing, you know, the pre-production so we can move ahead with the stuff that we want to get done now. But, man, that'll be awesome. I'd love to just cut you loose, man, and just see what you come up with.
I'd love to, and I've always wanted to do a Western as well. I haven't had the chance to do a Western, so...
I'll
be all over that, you know, yeah.
The hope is that movies like the Tarantino film that's coming out Christmas...
Yeah, Django Unchained, yeah.
Are going to reinvigorate the market for the Western.
Right.
I think that in America, the appetite is there.
Mm-hmm.
It's been proved with the little miniseries that Kevin Costner did.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Hatfields and the McCoys, and then True Grit did pretty good. And, you know, mm-hmm. So there's been these little signs, these little foreboding warning signs that the Western might be coming back. Mm-hmm. And I feel good that we're at the beginning of that curve. You know, we're shooting in April, and we're not, you know, waiting until, you know, there's 16 Westerns all lined up. And they go ahead and ruin the genre again, which they will. But,
yeah, oversaturation will do that.
What I'm hopeful with the Tarantino stuff, I'm hopeful it'll actually open some more eyes out there to the spaghetti Western, which is what I'm hoping will happen. Will and I are huge fans of spaghetti, so.
Yeah, so I just got the Django series with Franco Nero.
King.
Right? It's Nero, right?
Yeah, he's the king, Franco Nero.
He's the man.
Awesome. What a good-looking Italian, man. Jesus, he must have got so much pussy back in the day.
Okay.
Fucking Italian. You know, he's blonde, blue-eyed, like the best-looking guy in the world. A little too good-looking, you know? I mean, but once you start, you know, enjoying the movies, they're fantastic, man.
Yeah, you did a lot of good work.
Of course, one of my favorites is A Bullet for the General.
We covered that on the show. Damiani is one of my favorite directors.
Yeah,
that game. Fantastic.
And what,
a great
and what about The Mercenary?
Yeah,
yep.
The Mercenary. Yeah.
Corbucci, or what the
hell
is that name?
Yes, Corbucci.
Sergio Corbucci. Yeah. He might be the most underappreciated director in the genre. He
really is. And The Mercenary is very cool.
Yes.
In fact, we're not doing a spaghetti western, but we're referencing a lot of that stuff in the movie, and I think the fans of spaghetti westerns will catch a lot of different little Easter eggs for them put out in our film.
You got to throw some snow in there, Tom, like The Great Silence.
Yeah, Great Silence. Yeah,
Great Silence. Great movie.
That's the best. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's. It's the same guy that did the
Corbucci.
Yeah, Corbucci. For the General. Oh, it's Corbucci, that's right.
Yeah, Corbucci, yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the greats.
So I've just been getting into all that stuff. And there's a great, if anybody hasn't checked out the Sartana series, if you guys know about
the trilogy,
there's
ten
of them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, even more.
Yep. There's a whole bunch of them. Yeah. They're essentially kind of a derivative, kind of like of the Django thing. There's like three that are official Sartanas, but there's like seven or eight or maybe even 10 other Sartanas, I believe, where they just kind of slap the name on there. But, yeah, we're going to talk about those sometime soon. Yul Brynner has, got a great look. And, of course, Van Cleef is.
Van Cleef took over after Brynner, right?
Yeah, I think it was Van Cleef and then Brynner, and then Van Cleef came back or something like that. So, but Van Cleef, one of the great faces in cinema history, so.
Yeah, man. I mean, he was just born to be doing what he did.
Yeah.
That's so nice to see,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't make him like Van Cleef anymore. There's no doubt about that.
There's just no doubt. We won't get into that. Whatever is going on now, the pussification of Hollywood,
Kendall,
or whatever you want to call it.
Dome. Hey, Tom, I wanted to ask you, it's speaking a lot of faces, one of my favorite kind of insane films you did was Nemesis with Albert Pyun. I mean, there's so many names in that film, from Tim Thomerson, Tom Matthews, Brian James,
Brian
Haley, Branscombe Richmond, Sven Ole Thorsen. I mean, there's just top to bottom with a lot of great character actors. Do you remember anything about working on that film with Pyun specifically?
Well, that's all Albert Pyun, man. That's all him. You know, he is a very underrated director. His Cyborg movie is a really, really powerful, great movie. You know, his last Fight in the Rain. It's just classic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, and he's been ripped off a number of times. But Albert Pyun was a real smart guy. He's a Hawaiian guy, and he lived, we shot the movie in Hawaii. I'm pretty sure he shot all his movies over there, but I wouldn't know, because I only worked on the one. But Billy Idol was supposed to do the part that I
did.
And they called me, and they said, Billy Idol just dropped out of this part. you come in and read for it. And I was like, it's exciting. I hadn't done very much at all, But I knew about Cyborg, so I rushed over there to do it. And then, of course, I met Brian James over there, and we had a great time. He's since passed away, but he was a terrific actor and a lovely guy. And it was really fun working with those guys, We had a blast. It was real. It was a family. The crew had all worked together lots of times before, and most of the actors knew each other. I'll never forget the scene I did of this nice woman who I was doing the scene with. She had a big bowl of ice water under the bed, and before each take, she'd dip each breast into the ice water bowl. I was a young guy. I'd never seen anything like that, and just the way this behind-the-scenes Hollywood stuff, and I'm watching her dip her tits in the ice water bowl. It was fun. I thought, this is the business I want to be in.
All
right. can you maybe rattle off some of your cinematic heroes, some of the actors, actresses that or filmmakers even that you just you admire, you love?
There's got to be. It has to start with Ford. But also Buster Keaton. You know, the way his inventiveness and what he did with the camera is has a huge impact on cinema. So I think he would probably be the first, you know. I think that, you know, and I love Charlie Chaplin, and he's the master. And I actually just watched his movie, Limelight. And if anybody has not seen Limelight, you know, and I feel sorry for you. And I also feel sorry for the fact that you're probably going to go and rent it on Netflix and watch it after you've heard this conversation to check it out. But I feel sorry for you doing that too, because Limelight is meant to be seen, you know, in a theater with an audience. And I got lucky enough to, I'm a member of the Academy, and they just made me a member last year, I think. And so I go down there on the weekend, Monday night, a couple weeks ago, they showed Limelight, and they had Clara Bow. Get the names all wrong, but they had wonderful actress from the movie who's still alive, and they had Norman Lloyd, who's still alive, and he's 98 years old, and they come and they talk about their experience working with Charlie Chaplin. I mean, this is what's cool, man. This piece of cinema history, there's still living people connected to it. You know, Limelight was made in 1952 or early 50s, and it was one of Charlie's last films, and Charlie was, you know, getting up there, but you know, this is the, you know, Charlie Chaplin is the beginning of cinema, you know, and we're working with guys. I mean, I was sitting and got to meet Norman Lloyd, you know, and walk him over to the limousine at the end of the night and shake his hand. And, you know, you're shaking hands with the guy that shook hands with Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, I know.
Amazing. But, yeah. But fuck all that. The movie. I mean, nuts back there. The movie is incredible. It's one of the most moving portraits of an artist I've ever seen. You know, Charlie Chaplin worked on it for years. It's incredibly autobiographical, and it's one of the most beautiful cinematic achievements I've ever seen. It's a stunning work of art. It's, you know, because of Charlie's genius and because he did most of his genius work in the 20s and the teens, Limelight is so overlooked. It's actually, I think, his crowning achievement.
Wow, I gotta see it. I've
so
seen it.
There's Chaplin, there's Keaton, there's John Ford, there's Orson Welles, of course.
Oh yeah.
For me personally, there's Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
And that the, you know, the line for me. Alan Parker and Ridley Scott occupy the same space that the cinematic kind of elegance and beauty that is very important to my own personal sort of etiquette or outlook, inspirations. But actor-wise,
wonder if he cut out there. Are you guys not hearing?
No, he was in the movie.
Impact on me as a young actor, as a young man. You know, I those movies used to come on TV when I was in elementary school, and then the next day, my mother had a floppy tablet that was really for. I wore it to school, and as well as this kind of serape looking thing, and I'd stand around the playground and kind of stand apart from all the other kids and just kind of, you know, squint my eyes a little bit, and then, you know, my friend would come over and, you know, he'd come up to me and he'd go, "What are you doing, dude?" And I'd be like, "You talking to me?" And he'd be like, "Dude, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly was on last night. I saw it too, asshole." And it's funny. You know, that stuff had an impact on me, you know, and I noticed, like, how come I'm the only guy here that's, you know, really moved by this stuff?
Right.
And, you know, well, come to find out, I'm just a film geek.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it's going to be.
Amen.
And I'm okay with it. You know, I like it that way. Mm-hmm. And I loved, Rutger Hauer in Blade Runner. That was a, you know, and of course Harrison Ford.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I had a huge impact on me. All of his movies, and you know, I was, you know, just a young kid when Indiana Jones and Star Wars came out. But it was Blade Runner that cemented Harrison Ford for me, you know, more so than the other movies, even though I love the other movies. Blade Runner was much more my style.
Me too, yeah.
It was something that appealed to me personally.
Right.
I have to say my personal three favorite films that I enjoy the most, maybe not the most technically accomplished, but maybe, have to be Blade Runner, Alien, and 2001, Space
Very
Odyssey.
Cool.
You know, those three movies had the deepest and longest lasting impact on me as an artist. And then, of course, the Western had a huge impact on me, just watching them on TV with my dad, like so many people.
Yeah.
You know, watching them on Sunday afternoon with my pop, mm-hmm. and watching all the old, some of the John Wayne stuff, and then some, but the Clint Eastwood stuff is stuff that impressed me the most, you know, being a kid growing up in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, he was so pervasive in the 70s. I mean, that was, you know, that was when he was transitioning into Dirty Harry, and
right.
Really became a thing, yeah.
Yeah, and the 70s and 80s were, you know, definitely the huge, Clint Eastwood had a big impact on culture.
Right, yeah. He's a cultural icon as much as he is an actor after, you know,
right.
Like stuff he did in the 70s
yeah.
and stuff, but yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and that's affected me. I've seen, every actor kind of has to become the animal that they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen culture kind of, you know, die away from, you know, I think the 80s with the Stallone and the Schwarzenegger and the, you know, that you know, kind of the thing that then had it begun with Charles Bronson, Lee Marvin,
yeah.
Clint Eastwood, you know, which in a strange way is more intellectual than the, you know, just guns and muscles of Dan, you know, was the biggest movie star in the world when I was a kid, and then Arnold Schwarzenegger and Stallone and you know, all these other guys who I don't even want to mention. I had to take over, and then the cultural reaction to that was to kind of subvert all that entirely and go with a kind of a prepubescent, or at least a kind of a feminized male star.
Yeah.
And that is the kind of world that I grew up in, you know. And when I first came to Hollywood, it was all about sort of Rob Lowe and Johnny Depp, who's a fine actor, and he's managed to not only transcend but subvert his own image or pop image of himself, mm-hmm. and that's been really clever. But it was not a good time for guys who, you know, who were maybe not cut out of that kind of cloth.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
And even today, you know, I still kind of find I have a little bit of trouble trying to find something that I can fit into, you know, well. Even when I get hung, they wanted to shave all the hair off my chest. You know?
Oh, man.
No. Thank you.
Yeah.
Too much of a sheen on Hollywood today.
Yeah, everything's too pretty nowadays, and that is a problem, and me and Will both feel the same way. The tough guy cinema that we grew up on, and we're pretty much of the same generation that you are, you know, those actors would not even be given a second look now. You're talking about lead actors like Clint Eastwood, Charles Bronson, I mean, even Chuck Norris, some of these guys.
Right.
I mean, these guys,
Hackman,
would,
Marvin,
yeah, these guys wouldn't be given a second look now. Nowadays it would be, you know, much younger. It's like you say, this pre-Rush look. Yeah. Rush Hider's a good example, yeah. But
I'm hoping that, you know, I've been open for a long time, but I do see, I mean, we have to kind of create it, you know, we've got to,
yeah.
we've got it created. And what I think is that there is a market for all that stuff. You know, there's plenty of people who are more than happy to see that stuff get done. You know, the truth is that it's a multifaceted problem, because not only, you know, you're dealing with that on the actor side, but also writers, you know, writers have not, you know, they've kind of forgotten how to write that stuff, you know, and the truth is they're not as well read as the writers who were writing in the 60s and 70s and you know, and dare I say even the 80s. But, you know, finding guys who can understand how to create a character like the Punisher is really hard. You know? And I've been looking, you know, I love writers and I love writing and I love reading. So I've been looking for that for a long time. I finally found Chad St. John, you know, and I read his script like I read so many others, but I called up his agent and said, I got to meet this guy. Could I please, you know, buy him a cup of coffee? And we've been friends ever since, because he's, as Jonathan Hensley coined the phrase, he's a man of the cloth. Mm. And finding those guys and trying to sort of stick with them and create a little bit of a community, you know, and hopefully something creative will arise from that. I'm driving up the hill here to my house, and now we might get cut off. So if we do, just call me back.
Okay.
And I'll, once we get up to the house, the reception will be fine.
Okay.
I'm going to go up to the house here, and I want to talk about some samurai movies too, because I've been studying a lot of those, because there's a lot of crossover with the Western. You know, there's Kurosawa was very influenced by John Ford, and then you know, a lot of people have been influenced by Kurosawa. So
yeah,
so there's a lot of terrific material to be mined there.
Mm-hmm.
Themes are comparable, yeah.
I think we've reached an age where it almost becomes a postmodern approach to film, where if you're not referencing, okay, there seems to be two ways to make a movie. One is to throw three cameras up or five and then let them roll and then cut it all together like salad. And you're basically making film salad, you know, and that's basically how studio movies made today.
Yeah.
Film hamburger, my daughter said. And
film hamburgers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's basically how this Hollywood system makes a movie. And the other way to make a movie is really, you know, there's really not a shot or an idea that, I'm not saying you can't be original, but it's very hard to be unique. You know, most likely you're referencing something that's been done if you know where to look for it. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying that can be a great thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that in this day and age, and I think Tarantino kind of pioneered that to some extent, certainly a lot of other directors who reference other films and other directors. I mean, shit, there's a, you know,
De Palma,
a name for it in French, but,
right. Yeah.
but we can start to build almost like a film library of filmic references that people can enjoy, even if you've never seen the movie that you're referencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
And I think that at least that's what's turning me on as a filmmaker, the guy who's getting ready to make his second film. The stuff that's turning me on is watching all this old John Ford and watching all the samurai movies and seeing the references that can be sort of mined, and also the way that, you know, the way that when they wrote the scripts for The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and Bertolucci, right? And he was putting in all these references to other Westerns that he loved. He's throwing, you know, Johnny Guitar.
Oh, yeah.
Psychological Nicholas Ray Western, Lonely or the Brave. He's throwing in all these references to other Westerns, and they're inside the spaghetti Western. And if you've seen all the other Westerns, then you can, it enriches the experience of watching the movie.
Yes. It absolutely does. Sorry to cut you off, Tom, but I think that when you said about being a film fan and an unapologetic film lover, I think that's the big thing we all get out of this is coming full circle and then watching, like, when you mentioned Buster Keaton, for me, when I watch Buster Keaton, I'm a big Jackie Chan fan. I like a lot of 80s Hong Kong stuff. It's like, holy cow, fast forward 60 years, and Jackie Chan's doing the same stuff Buster Keaton was in the 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're also sort of putting their new spin on it, and they've got new technology, and they can take things, they can take ideas that Buster Keaton had and take further, but it's so much more enriching to be able to see their and draw from the references that Jackie Chan is using. And, you know, you mm-hmm. can point them out and you say, hey, I know what movies he's referencing there. And then beyond that, you're actually, when it really resonates, both movies are referencing classic stories in themselves or myths
mm-hmm. yeah.
Or you know, stories from the Greeks, you know, or even classic American stage characters. You know, you can reference the iconic imagery that can resonate sort of through the ages and through generations. And I think that, you know, today we're so oversaturated with so much stuff that, for me, that's what I find interesting. That's where my interest is headed, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You worked with, I knew you worked in a variety of stuff, Tom, but when I just kind of looked at it as a snapshot and took inventory of all the different filmmakers that I adore that you've worked with, it just kind of, it blew my socks off. I mean, you've worked with John Woo, speaking of 80s Hong Kong and revolutionary action, Terrence Malick, I mean, Rennie Harlan. Do you find a through line in working with certain directors or certain kinds of directors, or, you know, just in terms of, I guess, working with them in general, any observations you have, you know, would be, we really appreciate.
Well, you know, it's not by accident. I've sought out these directors because they're my favorite directors.
Very cool.
You know, even if it's just a scene or two in the movie, and I don't have to be the lead in the film, but I wanted to see what they were doing. You know, I wanted mm-hmm. to see what makes a Terry Malick film different than just in regular any other film. You know, what's yeah. he doing? How is he creating? How is he getting those images? How is he getting those performances?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I've always had in the back of my mind to be a filmmaker. You know, even when I was watching the movies, I was most impressed by the filmmaking. I was, you know, the acting was secondary for me. I was yeah. impressed by acting. I love acting. And, but, you know, acting had its golden age in the 50s, man. Mm-hmm. You know, the 50s and some of the 60s. You know, and yeah, what we saw in the 70s with De Niro and Pacino was really just the last gasp
mm-hmm.
of really connected, grounded acting that resonated with people and meant something. Acting doesn't mean very much anymore, I'm sorry to say. I think that it can, and I yeah. think that it can to certain people. But as far as being something that reaches popular culture and has an impact, that was the 50s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was when people were waking up psychologically, and they were waking up politically, and you know, they were coming out of a war that was very that had sort of ripped people apart, you know. And for the first time, the innocence of America was broken. The 40s were over. The 50s were coming up. Kids who were deeply affected by their parents' actions in World War II were now coming up, and they were saying, "What the fuck?"
Yeah,
and that was the 50s and 60s, and that you know, spawned some fantastic film and some great acting. But since then, you can have, you know, great performances and all that stuff, and they're fun to look at. But mm-hmm. I personally just don't, you know. I mean, when you look around and you counted all the great actors that were working in the 70s and the 80s and, yeah, the 90s, the list was as long as your arm. But if you look yeah. around today, pal, I'm sorry, man, but I got 10 fingers, and I don't know if I could.
Yeah.
You know, I could, but I don't know if an average guy could come up with actors who are on the level of, you know, of a Montgomery Clift or a John Garfield or Marlon Brando or, you know, Geraldine Page. I mean, you know, it's just, we're on another level now. It's hard to say.
It's that thing of branding. The film is more about making a brand to push merchandise than it is about the art. And I think the intersection of art and commerce has kind of become broken, and it's swung, or the pendulum has swung so far. We have commerce that I think, like you said, unfortunately, the acting isn't resonating in popular culture. It's more about the brand and the merchandise, sadly.
Yeah, but that has to change. There has to be a reaction to that, and I'm hoping that we see it, you know. And I know there's hope that the internet might produce something significant, but mostly we have to become aware of it. You know, the public at large has to say, you know, I don't like this hamburger. You know, how are you, what are you feeding these cows?
Yeah.
You know, you got to kind of wake up a little, and we'll see if that happens.
Hey, Tom, can I ask you a question? Did you actively yourself seek out Phil Joannou to do the Dirty Laundry short?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Oh, nice, because I'm a huge fan of Phil Joannou, and he's...
me too, you know, he's great.
I just had to know that, because it was just like this weird serendipitous moment. I had just watched 3 o'clock High a week before, and then I was like, I'm going to check out this Dirty Laundry short. And so I went and checked the Dirty Laundry short out, and I see the same director pop up. I'm like, that's insane. And I just feel like Phil doesn't get enough work. I mean, I really wish he worked more.
Well, you know, again, that's why, one of the reasons why I sought him out.
Nice.
You know, because I, you know, guys who are, it's going to be a lot harder to get, you know, a guy who's doing 3 movies a year, but also, you know, to find guys who are truly talented, who really know the art of filmmaking, they're few and far between, you know.
Yeah.
And Phil will have, I have to believe that the cream will rise.
Right.
And you know, one of the intentions of doing Dirty Laundry was to, you know, remind people what a great filmmaker Phil Joannou is.
Yes.
And, you know, remind my business.
Yeah.
That there's some great artists sitting here that you could be, you know, putting to use. But Phil, you know, it's not from lack of choice. Phil, you know, he hasn't worked because he doesn't want to. I mean, he's one of the guys that wants to do the real stuff, and he knows how hard it is, and he knows that, you know, ultimately you're going to be incredibly disappointed by bashing your head up against a brick wall that's not going to change if you're trying to play, you know, if you're trying to make a commercial movie in a commercial world. You're not going to be able to do it with the integrity that Phil, you know, wants to do it at.
Mm-hmm.
So I applaud him for, you know, sticking to his guns or his principles or whatever you want to call it, and he's, you know, he's got great taste, and he needs to have material that's going to come up to his level.
Right.
But he said he had the most amount of fun making that movie, you know, that we were just making just for the love of it, you know.
Yeah.
Very cool.
There wasn't a pitch involved, and there wasn't anybody telling us it had to be one way or the other. We made it because we loved it, and that was great. You know, I got Chad together and Phil and the three of us, and with Ron Perlman, we just made a great team.
Yeah,
you've done quite a bit of work with Perlman.
Yeah, Ron's a good friend. You know, did we meet? Did me and Ron meet on Mutant Chronicles, Davey?
Yeah, I think it was. I think that was the first time you met. Yeah.
We heard a good story about Ron.
Yeah. Match made in heaven.
Yeah, Dave gave us a great story about Ron.
Ron's affection for ribs, eating ribs at lunch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think every time I went by the set and it was lunchtime, I could guarantee that Ron, chicken or ribs, fried chicken or ribs. It was a bit of like, you know, like Bands and Riders. He had to have ribs.
That's great. Yeah, Ron, we had a great time, and it was a lot of fun because I got to meet Dave Alcock and I got to meet Ron Perlman and make some good friends, and
work over in London, you know. It was really fun, you know, and I love the look of the film. I think it turned out really kind of fun looking. It's a nice little genre film. But the friends that I got to make on that movie, kind of really great. And Ron and I stayed in touch, and you know, he lives right down the street from me, so I see him all the time.
Nice.
As opposed to Alcock, who lives on the other side of the pond, so we don't get to see each other as much.
I know. What a shame.
It is. But it's probably for the best. Because
yeah,
he's probably dead by now.
Judging by our last amount of time we spent, it's probably for the best, yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I know our...
Yeah, the jails are crowded enough. They don't need that.
I know our time's a little limited, so I don't know, Will, I don't know how many more questions you want to ask, if you want to get into the topic, you want to do the listener questions.
I'll ask Tom, and then I'll base it on that, because I don't want to, I don't want to understand.
Yeah, you know, I got my kid here, but we have a few more minutes.
Okay. There's a couple of questions we probably just want to ask you more, just as a film fan, if we may, unless there's anything before we get to that, Tom, mm-hmm. that you want to mention to people, like as far as projects, mm-hmm. things to keep their eyes out for that you got going on cinematically or otherwise.
Well, like I said, you know, the thing that I'm most excited about right now is directing this Western come April in Monument Valley.
Yep.
We're going to shoot in a lot of the same spots that John Ford shot in. And,
nice.
And we'll be throwing in a lot of references to some of my favorite Westerns. And you know, and there's a little bit of spaghetti in there, too. But if there's a really just a classic, you know, kind of traditional Western that we're going to tell.
Very nice.
But I'm excited about that one. And then, you know, I got the Dark Country graphic novel in the stores now. You can pick that up and see Alcock's work in it and see our creation. And, you know, and that's it right now.
Good stuff. One more. Sorry, go ahead.
No, we're always working on some fun stuff. I got this great guy named Sean O'Connor, who's actually a UK resident, and he's doing a graphic novel for us called The Lichen. It's takes place in the late 1700s, and it's kind of like The Magnificent Seven, but with werewolves. And there's a castle, and it's very gothic. And it's really great. Mike Carey, who's another wonderful UK writer, Eisner Award-winning writer. He wrote the script for us, and that's going to be a terrific little graphic novel. I have that out next year sometime.
And what was that? What was that one called?
That's called The Lichen.
The Lichen. Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, and you can check us out at rawstudios.com. We got a great forum there. A lot of folks on the forum, and a lot of artists, and a lot of writers, and a lot of people who enjoy that stuff at rawstudios.com. And we also have a great alternative film section in the Raw Studios forum. And that's probably our most popular thread. They get a list of some great, you know, little seen or little known movies go on there, and people are throwing on stuff that they've seen and stuff they really enjoy all the time. So it's a great source.
Yeah, cool.
To pick up some ideas, you know, if you're looking for something to watch on Friday night.
Yeah, I was looking through that earlier, and I knew this was a great thread when I saw Zardoz as the first film.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to see it on the big screen soon. It's coming here to the Lightbox. I'm going to go see it in December on the big screen.
Zardoz.
Right on.
That's a
favorite. Wear my bandolier and my red diaper. That'll be good.
What a great film. Oh, every now and then they just turn out great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. Hey, Tom, I got one more personal one and then just one from a listener. Rick, is there anyone you wanted to ask Tom before?
No, I know one of our questions was going to be greatest cinematic mustache, but Tom, I got to say, you grow a great mustache.
Oh.
And it must be great to be known, to be part of what I consider one of the greatest scenes shot in cinema history, which is the Sister Christian moments in Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
That is literally, to me, like 10 of the best minutes ever put on celluloid ever.
Yeah, it is tremendous.
You know, when I read the script, and I hadn't done very much as an actor, and we just showed Boogie Nights down at the New Beverly Cinema here in Hollywood, and I went down and did a little talk, and that was really fun, and we got to reminisce a little bit about making Boogie Nights, but I was a young actor and hadn't done very much, but the casting director sent me that script, and it was 180 pages long, and, you know, I knew enough to know that that was really long for a script, but that scene, it was, I couldn't put it down, by the way, you know, the script was so great, but that scene just popped off the page in such a way that I thought it was easily the best scene in the movie.
Yeah, and this is
a part of Todd Parker, you know, he was the guy in that scene, so I was like, I gotta audition for this guy.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I went and, you know, got that part and got to do it, but I was, but let me tell you, it read just as good as it filmed, you know, and that's not easy. You know, that's a testament to Paul, as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
To be able to pull off the kind of tension and the kind of mood that you can put across on paper, you know, and then to actually bring it to life is a whole another ball of wax. And he pulled that off to the T.
I see
a lot of scripts, you know, and I do some of the movies that I've done. Most of the movies I've done have actually started out as really great scripts, and you know, you look at some of them and you're like, why the fuck did he do that movie? But it started out as a great script, you know. It's not always easy to
make the transition. If I had to make a list of like the 10 greatest scenes ever in film, trust me, that scene would be in there. I mean, it's that great.
It's one of the best.
It is so good. And a film full of tremendous scenes. I mean, it does stand out. And yeah, but your mustache was, to bring a full circle with that, was, I mean, you want to talk about Franco Nero. I mean, you could run with Nero with that stash, sir. It's tremendous. Tremendous.
Very nice thing to say.
One more question for me, Tom, on a personal level, and then I'll just ask one for a listener, and we're happy to let you go because I know your time's limited. As a film fan, being someone that adores film like you do, excluding the United States, what one country, if you can only watch film from one country for the rest of your life, what country would it be?
Well, for me, it would be Italy.
Yeah.
I love France.
Yes.
You know, but it has to be Italy.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, you've got Rossellini and Bertolucci and Fellini and Leone. I mean, the list goes on and on, but, you know, you could really do well watching movies. I mean, it's kind of a neck and neck thing, you know. France also had some amazing filmmakers, and
Japan,
you know, the pool, actually the pool from which you can dip into might be a little deeper in France. In other words, there might be a little bit more to draw from the French cinema. But as far as passion and, you know, chiaroscuro, heartfelt Italian, you know, flavor, passion for life, you know, the Italians kind of can't be beat.
No.
It's the genres.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to live without all the Leone stuff. It had such a big impact on me, you know.
Yeah.
Once Upon a Time in the West and all that.
So, it's the genre stuff. I always, and I'm with you 100%. I'm Italy too. It's that genre, the sense of genre that Italy had, not only their great masterpieces, but also when they just turned into this genre turning out machine. Yeah, their B pictures blow away most of like any other country's B pictures.
Yeah, because the artistic, the film history in Italy was such that even their B pictures were made with such a technical, a high technical level that, you know, throws it above. In fact, Tom, that's one of the reasons we really wanted to interview you, was we had heard you'd done an interview on The Nerdist, and you'd mentioned the film The Italian Connection, which we are huge fans of that.
Fernando DeLeo.
Amen. One of my favorite filmmakers. And you had mentioned that. When you named out The Italian Connection, I thought, man, we got to get Thomas Jane on this show. Any lover of DeLeo is a friend of ours.
Yes.
All right. I love it. Yeah,
he is.
I think there's room to mine, you know, some more DeLeo, definitely. I've always called him DeLeo, but I'll call him DeLeo now for you. I was kind of surprised. I think you could really do some fun stuff with him, you know? As far as sort of a kind of on the remake side of things. Maybe not necessarily an out and out remake, but at least sort of drawing on those same themes and you know, that just that nice seedy train underbelly kind of fun. You know, it's the closest for me because I'm really into the pulp, it's 1960s pulp novels. You know, the pulp crime novels,
right.
The Harry Whittington stuff. I don't mm-hmm. know if you.
Yeah, I'm familiar
know,
with it.
Whittington. He, you know, if you don't, you really do yourself a favor and go out and, you know, and get yourself a couple of Harry Whittington novels. Doesn't really matter which one; they're all great. You know, and it's just such a great sort of, it's sort of a tough guy thing, but it's also kind of sad and it's emotional too. And, you know, it's, yeah, inability to express love and, you know, and the men who live by a code.
It's
really well done stuff. And I was looking for that, you know, in film, and I'm trying to do stuff like that. I haven't hit upon the, I've been reading it. I guess I'm just going to have to write it. You know, I just have to go up there and write this stuff and come up with it.
Tom, you know? I got to ask you.
You know, like Caliber 9 is one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great film.
Hugo Piazza.
I don't know if you've seen the Rulers of the City.
Rulers of the City with Jack Palance.
Yes.
That's a great one.
Yes.
Exactly. You know, and New Palance, who was going around doing these Westerns, and then he would go do the crime films. He had a great career.
Yeah. He did.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me.
You know, he's
we
his
wanted
first
to...
film, he was the bad guy in Sheen.
Yeah.
Yes. Possibly the greatest bad guy of all time, in my opinion.
Probably the greatest bad guy of all time.
Yes. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned your love, your love of Charles Bronson a little bit, but just to bring back one of our other patron saints on the show, one that we talk about all the time that we think is arguably maybe the most underrated actor of all time, is the great
Once
Henry.
Upon a Time in the West, I think that's the greatest performance. And to be coming, what other actor in the world, on the planet, would be able to follow Clint Eastwood coming off the Spaghetti Western trilogy, right?
Yeah.
The Dollars trilogy, you're coming off of that, and who, where the hell do you go? You don't want to use Clint, but who the fuck are you going to use? Bronson is the only guy
in
the world. There's nobody alive today that you could cast and would have that kind of impact.
No.
And he just nailed that performance, you know. And he's like, you're like, who could be as cool as Clint Eastwood? Oh, Charles fucking Bronson.
That's
yes.
it.
In the Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yes.
You know, the greatest profile. He was lit so well. His hat was fucking the perfect shape for his face. And he was just such a fucking badass. Not only that, he played a fucking harmonica. Who are you going
to
give an actor a harmonica and say, here, play this and look cool and fucking look like you're going to kill somebody, but here's a harmonica. Yeah, right. You know, these were comedies. Not a lot of people realize that when Leone was making these movies, they were intended as comedies. And then they went completely over the edge when they did Duck, You Sucker, Fistful of Dynamite.
Yeah.
And that, you know, went too far. But all of those movies, they're intended as comedic. You know, that classic Morricone score when you're... That's funny. That's like... That's hilarious.
Yes,
but,
it
you
is.
Know, it was so funny because then in America, as kids, when we saw this stuff, we didn't get the joke. It was just like the coolest thing we'd ever seen.
Yes, yes. I have to ask you, do you have a fondness for Henry Silva as well?
We love some Silva.
Yeah, no, of course. Henry Silva, I want to say, remind me what movie are we talking about?
He was in an Italian Connection. He was the yellow house-coated hitman with Woody Strode.
Oh, okay, yeah. I like Woody Strode better myself.
Oh, okay.
Strode's
okay.
Yeah, I mean,
no,
he's great, he's fine. I like him, you know. But he doesn't churn my butter, as they say. Woody Strode, though, that dude.
Yeah.
You know, he's a badass. That guy I love.
I got to say, Tom, if you allow me to make one film recommendation for you, please try to check out Henry Silva and Cry of a Prostitute. Trust me.
Yes.
You definitely need to check that film. Yes.
We can get it to you. I mean, we're happy with all. We have libraries of this Italian crime stuff.
I love it.
And, you know, he does this. It's sort of like, It's sort of like Silva doing a really sleazy Italian crime version of Yojimbo with Barbara Boucher.
Yeah,
it's pretty tremendous, and it's sleazy. It's fantastic. It takes place in the countryside in Sicily. It's one of our pantheon films on our show.
Yes.
Oh, I love it, man. That's good. Well, yeah, turn me on. I love it. There's so many movies that I haven't seen. And how can I resist something called Cry of the Prostitute?
Exactly.
Great. I'll wrap this up here, Thomas.
I'm going to try to turn you on to a movie. You've probably seen it. Have you seen the film Blast of Silence?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Brilliant.
That's something that I pull out about once a year and watch this. I don't know any of the movies this guy did. Alan Baron or whatever his name is. It's one of my favorite. Sort of unknown movies. If anybody out there wants to see, I think there's a Criterion edition now, but that's kind of a crappy transfer, but Blast of Silence, man. That's another great one.
Oh, nice pull. Yeah. Very nice pull.
That's nice.
Thank you.
I do want to just find one final one from one of our listeners, because we said we promised. They had a ton of questions, but one of them was, and I think you've kind of answered these inadvertently through the interview, But I'll just pick one randomly here. One of our listeners in South Korea said he wanted to tell you that he loves Thursday. He's got it on DVD. It's very hard to come by. He said you and Eckhart nail it. But he wanted to know if you know what the status is of it. Like, is there any sort of release plan for it? This is Tim, of course.
That movie we did quite a long time ago, and I think that they did a limited number of DVDs release and that's it. And I think that's why it's hard to find. And it's also really expensive if you do find it. Mm-hmm. Mickey Rourke and James LeGros, who's also great, had a great cast.
Oh, yeah.
The script was excellent. It was by this guy named Skip Woods, who went on to write Swordfish and some other fun bubblegum type stuff. But Thursday is actually a script that I would like to remake someday. And I might try to option that script one day and redo it. It was Skip Woods, who's never directed a film, but he's a writer, and he's a very, very talented guy. And they brought him out from Texas, and they let him direct this little movie. And he got a great cast together because it's a terrific script. But the movie itself, has a lot of fans. I personally hated the way it was shot. I didn't like the cinematography in that film. But I love the... love the story, and it was fun. It was one of my first starring roles, so I'm I can't watch myself at all in the movie, but I had a good time doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that I saw a special edition that was out. I think, every now and then I'll be at a comic book convention and I'll be signing crap, and somebody presented to me just a couple weeks ago, I saw this version of a DVD that I'd never seen before. So I think there exists out there some foreign DVD version that actually looks pretty decent. It looks really well put together.
Oh, nice.
So keep your eyes out for some. I'm sorry, I don't have more information than that.
No, definitely.
I have to say, it is a stroke of genius to have you and Eckhart cast as brothers.
Yeah, I know. Every now and then, at the airport, somebody will go, "Are you Aaron Eckhart?" And I'll be like, "No, Nick, come on, you're Aaron." No, not.
Oh, nice.
Excellent.
All right, I guess that's, we appreciate your time, Tom. We've
truly
very thankful. I would like to just, offer you anytime you would like to be on our show, or if we could ever talk to you again, that would be great. We'd love it.
If you have something you want to, you're promoting, anything, any projects you want to talk about, any films you want to talk about, if you want to drop on people, it would be an honor and a privilege.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, you guys keep my information, and something comes up, and you want to talk to me about it, you know how to find me.
That sounds good.
Davey knows how to find me, so I'd love to come back on. It's always fun talking to guys who are of like mind, and they like this kind of stuff like I do, so it's really cool.
Sure.
And it's not, you guys are out there hopefully growing the community and turning some people on to some great stuff, getting them off of Cinemax or Skinemax or whatever.
Yeah.
And turn them on to some real chinema.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. And I promise you, we will get you sorted with some Italian stuff. We'll throw some pedals at you that'll really knock your socks off.
Great, man. I got an all-region player. And by the way,
that's the way to go.
Who does not have an all-region player, get yourself an all-region player.
Yeah.
You heard it here first, guys.
Yeah, you're not a film lover if you don't have an all-region player. That's just,
yeah.
That's the only way to go. I mean, this whole region thing is for the birds anyway.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Bullshit created by bullshit artists.
Yeah.
But, you know, we didn't talk about Japan at all, but I know we got to go, but, you know.
We'd love to have that conversation with you, though.
A close second on the one country.
Yes.
You know,
that was my
thing.
Choice. That was my choice, yeah. Japan and then Italy.
I don't know, man. I got to think about that. I never thought about it. I got to think deeper. I might be able to. I don't know.
We'll have you back on again sometime. We'll talk the samurai film versus westerns.
Yeah,
we'll talk
good.
Japan, Italy. We'll do it again. We'll do it again sometime.
Mifune and Sleepy Eyes of Death and some Lone Wolf and Cub.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get into that.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom.
Ozo stuff.
Yeah.
Yes, nice.
The samurai series, the samurai trilogy. Oh,
man.
Know,
I love that trilogy so much. on our show, we always say goodbye with the famous words of adios. Could you give us an adios for our listeners, and I'll let you go.
Adios, amigos.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Tom. It was great talking to you. It really was. We appreciate
much,
your time.
A lot of fun. Have fun. See you, Davey. Give me a call.
Will do. See you, Tom.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, guys, have a great night. Thank you again, Davey, and we'll all talk real soon.
Yes.
Pleasure.
Take care, guys.
All right. Bye.
See ya.
There goes Sam. All right. Well, Dave, it's up to me and you to say the adios. So without further ado, this is Samurai and the almighty Dave Alcock saying adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com. You can call the gentleman at 206-666-5207. And you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com. Thank you.